Because all the methods of mind are not understood, we say the lips or hands must move in order to convey thought, that the undulations of the air convey sound, and possibly that other methods involved so-called miracles. The realities of being, its normal action, and the origin of all things are unseen to mortal sense, whereas the unreal and imitative movements of mortal belief, which would reverse the immortal modus in action, are styled the real. Whoever contradicts this mortal mind supposition of reality is called a deceiver, or is said to be deceived. Of a man it has been said, as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Hence, as a man spiritually understandeth, so is he in truth. Mortal mind conceives of something as either liquid or solid, and then classifies it materially. Immortal and spiritual facts exist apart from this mortal and material conception. God, good, is self-existent and self-expressed, though indefinable as a whole. Every step towards goodness is a departure from materiality and is a tendency towards God, Spirit. Material theories partially paralyze this attraction towards infinite and eternal good by an opposite attraction towards the finite, temporary, and discordant. Sound is a mental impression made on mortal belief. The ear does not really hear. Divine science reveals sound as communicated through the senses of soul, through spiritual understanding. Mozart experienced more than he expressed. The rapture of his grandest symphonies was never heard. He was a musician beyond what the world knew. This was even more strikingly true of Beethoven, who was so long hopelessly deaf. Mental melodies and strains of sweetest music supersede conscious sound. Music is the rhythm of head and heart. Mortal mind is the harp of many strings, discoursing either discord or harmony, according as the hand which sweeps over it is human or divine. Before human knowledge dipped to its depths into a false sense of things, into belief in material origins which discard the one mind and true source of being, it is possible that the impressions from truth were as distinct as sound and that they came as sound to the primitive prophets. If the medium of hearing is wholly spiritual, it is normal and indestructible. If Enoch's perception had been confined to the evidence before his material senses, he could never have walked with God, nor been guided into the demonstration of life eternal. Adam, represented in the scriptures as formed from dust, is an object lesson for the human mind. The material senses, like Adam, originate in matter and return to dust, are proved non-intelligent. They go out as they came in, for they are still the error, not the truth of being. When it is learned that the spiritual sense, and not the material, conveys the impressions of mind to man, then being will be understood and found to be harmonious. We bow down to matter and entertain finite thoughts of God like the pagan idolater. Mortals are inclined to fear and to obey what they consider a material body more than they do a spiritual God. All material knowledge, like the original tree of knowledge, multiplies their pains, for mortal illusions would rob God, slay man, and meanwhile would spread their table with cannibal tidbits and give thanks. How transient a sense is mortal sight, when a wound on the retina may end the power of light and lens. But the real sight or sense is not lost. Neither age nor accident can interfere with the senses of soul, and there are no other real senses. It is evident that the body as matter has no sensation of its own, and there is no oblivion for soul and its faculties. Spirit's senses are without pain, and they are forever at peace. Nothing can hide from them the harmony of all things and the might and permanence of truth. If spirit, soul, could sin or be lost, then being and immortality would be lost, together with all the faculties of mind. But being cannot be lost while God exists. Soul and matter are at variance from the very necessity of their opposite natures. Mortals are unacquainted with the reality of existence, because matter and mortality do not reflect the facts of spirit. Spiritual vision is not subordinate to geometric altitudes. Whatever is governed by God is never for an instant deprived of the light and might of intelligence and life. We are sometimes led to believe that darkness is as real as light, but science affirms darkness to be only a mortal sense of the absence of light, at the coming of which darkness loses the appearance of reality. So sin and sorrow, disease and death, are the suppositional absence of life, God, and flee as phantoms of error before truth and love. With its divine proof, science reverses the evidence of material sense. Every quality and condition of mortality is lost, swallowed up in immortality. Mortal man is the antipode of immortal man in origin, in existence, and in his relation to God. Because he understood the superiority and immortality of good, Socrates feared not the hemlock poison. Even the faith of his philosophy spurned physical timidity. Having sought man's spiritual state, he recognized the immortality of man. The ignorance and malice of the age would have killed the venerable philosopher because of his faith in soul and his indifference to the body. Who shall say that man is alive today, but may be dead tomorrow? What has touched life, God, to such strange issues? Here theories cease, and science unveils the mystery and solves the problem of man. Error bites the heel of truth, but cannot kill truth. Truth bruises the head of error, destroys error. Spirituality lays open siege to materialism. On which side are we fighting? The understanding that the ego is mind, and that there is but one mind or intelligence, begins at once to destroy the errors of mortal sense and to supply the truth of immortal sense. This understanding makes the body harmonious. It makes the nerves, bones, brain, etc., servants instead of masters. If man is governed by the law of divine mind, his body is in submission to everlasting life and truth and love. The great mistake of mortals is to suppose that man, God's image and likeness, is both matter and spirit, both good and evil. If the decision were left to the corporeal senses, evil would appear to be the master of good, and sickness to be the rule of existence, while health would seem the exception, death the inevitable, and life a paradox. Paul asked, "What concord hath Christ with Belial?" When you say, "Man's body is material," I say with Paul, "Be willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord." Give up your material belief of mind in matter and have but one mind, even God. For this mind forms its own likeness. The loss of man's identity through the understanding which science confers is impossible, and the notion of such a possibility is more absurd than to conclude that individual musical tones are lost in the origin of harmony. Medical schools may inform us that the healing work of Christian Science and Paul's peculiar Christian conversion and experience, which prove mind to be scientifically distinct from matter, are indications of unnatural mental and bodily conditions, even of catalepsy and hysteria. Yet if we turn to the Scriptures, what do we read? Why, this: "If a man keep my saying, he shall never see death," and, "Henceforth know we no man after the flesh." That scientific methods are superior to others is seen by their effects. When you have once conquered a diseased condition of the body through mind, that condition never recurs, and you have won a point in science. When mentality gives rest to the body, the next toil will fatigue you less, for you are working out the problem of being in divine metaphysics. And in proportion as you understand the control which mind has over so-called matter, you will be able to demonstrate this control. The scientific and permanent remedy for fatigue is to learn the power of mind over the body or any illusion of physical weariness, and so destroy this illusion, for matter cannot be weary and heavy laden. You say, "Toil fatigues me." But what is this me? Is it muscle or mind? Which is tired and so speaks? Without mind, could the muscles be tired? Do the muscles talk, or do you talk for them? Matter is non-intelligent. Mortal mind does the false talking, and that which affirms weariness made that weariness. You do not say a wheel is fatigued, and yet the body is as material as the wheel. If it were not for what the human mind says of the body, like the inanimate wheel, would never be weary. The consciousness of truth rests us more than hours of repose in unconsciousness. The body is supposed to say, "I am ill." The reports of sickness may form a coalition with the reports of sin and say, "I am malice, lust, appetite, envy, hate." What renders both sin and sickness difficult of cure is that the human mind is the sinner disinclined to self-correction, and believing that the body can be sick independently of mortal mind, and that the divine mind has no jurisdiction over the body. Why pray for the recovery of the sick if you are without faith in God's willingness and ability to heal them? If you do believe in God, why do you substitute drugs for the Almighty's power and employ means which lead only into material ways of obtaining help, instead of turning in time of need to God, divine love, who is an ever-present help? Treat a belief in sickness as you would sin, with sudden dismissal. Resist the temptation to believe in matter as intelligent, as having sensation or power. The scriptures say, "They that wait upon the Lord shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint." The meaning of that passage is not perverted by applying it literally to moments of fatigue, for the moral and physical are as one in their results. When we wake to the truth of being, all disease, pain, weakness, weariness, sorrow, sin, death will be unknown, and the mortal dream will forever cease. My method of treating fatigue applies to all bodily ailments, since mind should be and is supreme, absolute, and final. In mathematics, we do not multiply when we should subtract, and then say the product is correct. No more can we say in science that muscles give strength, that nerves give pain or pleasure, or that matter governs, and then expect that the result will be harmony. Not muscles, nerves, nor bones, but mortal mind makes the whole body sick and the whole heart faint, whereas divine mind heals. When this is understood, we shall never affirm concerning the body what we do not wish to have manifested. We shall not call the body weak if we would have it strong. For the belief in feebleness must obtain in the human mind before it can be made manifest on the body, and the destruction of the belief will be the removal of its effects. Science includes no rule of discord, but governs harmoniously. "The wish," says the poet, "is ever father to the thought." We may hear a sweet melody and yet misunderstand the science that governs it. Those who are healed through metaphysical science, not comprehending the principle of the cure, may misunderstand it and impute their recovery to change of air or diet, not rendering to God the honor due to Him alone. Entire immunity from the belief in sin, suffering, and death may not be reached at this period, but we may look for an abatement of these evils, and this scientific beginning is in the right direction. We hear it said, "I exercise daily in the open air. I take cold baths in order to overcome a predisposition to take cold. And yet I have continual colds, catarrh, and cough." Such admissions ought to open people's eyes to the inefficacy of material hygiene and induce sufferers to look in other directions for cause and cure. Instinct is better than misguided reason, as even nature declares. The violet lifts her blue eyes to greet the early spring. The leaves clap their hands as nature's untired worshippers. The snowbird sings and soars amid the blasts. He has no catarrh from wet feet and procures a summer residence with more ease than a nabob. The atmosphere of the earth, kinder than the atmosphere of mortal mind, leaves catarrh to the latter. Colds, coughs, and contagion are engendered solely by human theories. Mortal mind produces its own phenomena and then charges them to something else, like a kitten glancing into the mirror at itself and thinking it sees another kitten. A clergyman once adopted a diet of bread and water to increase his spirituality. Finding his health failing, he gave up his abstinence and advised others never to try dietetics for growth in grace. The belief that either fasting or feasting makes men better morally or physically is one of the fruits of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, concerning which God said, "Thou shalt not eat of it." Mortal mind forms all conditions of the mortal body and controls the stomach, bones, lungs, heart, blood, etc., as directly as the volition or will moves the hand. I knew a person who, when quite a child, adopted the Graham system to cure dyspepsia. For many years, he ate only bread and vegetables and drank nothing but water. His dyspepsia increasing, he decided that his diet should be more rigid, and thereafter he partook of but one meal in 24 hours, this meal consisting of only a thin slice of bread without water. His physician also recommended that he should not wet his parched throat until 3 hours after eating. He passed many weary years in hunger and weakness, almost in starvation, and finally made up his mind to die, having exhausted the skill of the doctors, who kindly informed him that death was indeed his only alternative. At this point, Christian Science saved him, and he is now in perfect health without a vestige of the old complaint. He learned that suffering and disease were the self-imposed beliefs of mortals and not the facts of being. That God never decreed disease, never ordained a law that fasting should be a means of health. Hence, semi-starvation is not acceptable to wisdom, and it is equally far from science, in which being is sustained by God mind. These truths, opening his eyes, relieved his stomach, and he ate without suffering, giving God thanks. But he never enjoyed his food as he had imagined he would when, still the slave of matter, he thought of the flesh pots of Egypt, feeling childhood's hunger and undisciplined by self-denial and divine science. This newborn understanding that neither food nor the stomach, without the consent of mortal mind, can make one suffer, brings with it another lesson, that gluttony is a sensual illusion, and that this phantasm of mortal mind disappears as we better apprehend our spiritual existence and ascend the ladder of life. This person learned that food affects the body only as mortal mind has its material methods of working, one of which is to believe that proper food supplies nutriment and strength to the human system. He learned also that mortal mind makes a mortal body, whereas truth regenerates this fleshly mind and feeds thought with the bread of life. Food had less power to help or to hurt him after he had availed himself of the fact that mind governs man. And he also had less faith in the so-called pleasures and pains of matter, taking less thought about what he should eat or drink, consulting the stomach less about the economy of living, and God more. He recovered strength and flesh rapidly. For many years he had been kept alive, as was believed, only by the strictest adherence to hygiene and drugs, and yet he continued ill all the while. Now he dropped drugs and material hygiene and was well. He learned that a dyspeptic was very far from being the image and likeness of God, far from having dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle, if eating a bit of animal flesh could overpower him. He finally concluded that God never made a dyspeptic, while fear, hygiene, physiology, and physics had made him one contrary to his commands. In seeking a cure for dyspepsia, consult matter not at all, and eat what is set before you, asking no question for conscience' sake. We must destroy the false belief that life and intelligence are in matter and plant ourselves upon what is pure and perfect. Paul said, "Walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh." Sooner or later, we shall learn that the fetters of man's finite capacity are forged by the illusion that he lives in body instead of in soul, in matter instead of in spirit. Matter does not express spirit. God is infinite, omnipresent spirit. If spirit is all and is everywhere, what and where is matter? Remember that truth is greater than error, and we cannot put the greater into the less. Soul is spirit, and spirit is greater than body. If spirit were once within the body, spirit would be finite, and therefore could not be spirit. The question, what is truth, convulses the world. Many are ready to meet this inquiry with the assurance which comes of understanding, but more are blinded by their old illusions and try to give it pause. If the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. The efforts of error to answer this question by some ology are vain. Spiritual rationality and free thought accompany approaching science and cannot be put down. They will emancipate humanity and supplant unscientific means and so-called laws. Peals that should startle the slumbering thought from its erroneous dream are partially unheeded. But the last trump has not sounded, or this would not be so. Marvels, calamities, and sin will much more abound as truth urges upon mortals its resisted claims. But the awful daring of sin destroys sin and foreshadows the triumph of truth. God will overturn until he come whose right it is. Longevity is increasing and the power of sin diminishing, for the world feels the alterative effect of truth through every pore. As the crude footprints of the past disappear from the dissolving paths of the present, we shall better understand the science which governs these changes and shall plant our feet on firmer ground. Every sensuous pleasure or pain is self-destroyed through suffering. There should be painless progress attended by life and peace instead of discord and death. In the record of 19 centuries, there are sects many, but not enough Christianity. Centuries ago, religionists were ready to hail an anthropomorphic God and array his vicegerent with pomp and splendor. But this was not the manner of truth's appearing. Of old, the cross was truth's central sign, and it is today. The modern lash is less material than the Roman scourge, but it is equally as cutting. Cold disdain, stubborn resistance, opposition from church, state laws, and the press are still the harbingers of truth's full-orbed appearing. A higher and more practical Christianity, demonstrating justice and meeting the needs of mortals in sickness and in health, stands at the door of this age knocking for admission. Will you open or close the door upon this angel visitant, who cometh in the quiet of meekness, as he came of old to the patriarch at noonday?